Hail, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us here on the line from the Institute of the Constitution, Mr. David Whitney, and we're going to be talking about the Constitution of the United States. And, of course, if you want to understand the foundation of our freedom, you have to understand the Constitution and its origin. David, are you there?
Yes, good evening, Dr. Stan.
Well,
good to be on with you.
It's good to have you back again. And, of course, we're talking about the what has not been taught in our schools, really, for 50 years. The basic concept from whence freedom comes. Here in America, our freedom came from God, different than any other country there's ever been. In almost every other country, why, freedom came from the tribal chief, it came from the king, it came from the emperor, it came from the ruler, it came from the monarch, it came from the pharaoh. Anything, any rights the people had were granted to them by government. Here in the United States, why, the people got their freedom from God, and that was a statement of the Declaration of Independence. And then, of course, men put together a government to ensure those God-given rights, and that's what our Constitution did. It limited the power of government because our founding fathers realized that liberty and limited government were synonymous, and just as tyranny and total government were synonymous. Well, under any circumstances, we're beginning to go through the Constitution itself, and David has actually covered that in the past. So right now I think we're into what? Article 2 of the Constitution.
That's right.
Well, why don't you pick up the story from there?
Okay. You know, it's easy to remember the first three articles and what the subject matter is for the first three articles, because Article 1, as we already covered, is the legislative article. Article 2 is the executive branch, the presidency, and then Article 3 is the judiciary. So if you remember those three and you're looking for something particular to the judiciary, you'll know exactly where to look. Well, the Section 1 of Article 2 on the presidency deals with the term, the selection, the qualifications, as well as the succession of president, and the president was to serve a four-year term. Originally, however, there was no term limits. They had taken a vote in the Constitutional Convention for establishing a two-term limit, but they noted that Washington voted against it, and so it was later eliminated. And then Washington himself only served two terms and announced at the end of his second term that that was enough. And his example really set the tradition of a two-term limit all the way up until Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was elected four terms. And when he died in office in 1945, the nation then shortly thereafter enacted the 22nd Amendment, limiting the president to two terms. Everyone had had enough of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's tyranny.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with David Whitney. As we begin going through the various steps of the Constitution, we've already talked about Article 1, which has to do with the executive branch. This evening, we're going to talk about Article 2 and Article 3. You must understand the foundation of our freedom to understand from whence our freedoms come. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and with us this evening is David Whitney, and we're talking about the Constitution. We're talking about Article 2 of the Constitution, which has to do with the executive branch of government,
right,
with the president. Why don't you pick up the story from there, David?
The other aspect of Section 1 deals with the selection of the president through the Electoral College, and this is much debated today. I know in our last presidential election, the year 2000, there was a bunch of people, Hillary Clinton and others of her ilk, calling for the elimination of the Electoral College. They said it's an antiquated thing, unnecessary in our democracy, which, of course, we know that we don't have a democracy given to us by our founding fathers. They gave us a constitutional republic. And part of that constitutional republic is to place a check upon mobocracy, is what our founding fathers like to call it. That is the rule of a mob led by a particular demagogue. And the Electoral College was a process by which the president was actually chosen by electors, and those electors are chosen by the states. So there's two levels taking place there. Now, each state has a number of electors that equal their total number of senators and congressmen from that state. So a thinly populated state like Alaska would have two senators and one congressman, thus having three electors representing them in the Electoral College. Now, normally electors are pledged to support the candidates who carried their state, but also in that 2000 election, we heard the possibility that perhaps some of those electors might violate their pledge and become unfaithful electors, and all that kind of debate took place. But in the Electoral College itself, once the votes are cast, they're actually opened in the Senate and the House, if there is no majority of electors voting for one or another, if there's kind of a split, then the House is the one that actually chooses the president.
Isn't the requirement that one has to get the majority of the electors?
That's right. If they don't get it, the majority of the electors, then it has to go to the Congress to determine who becomes the president.
Well, now, what's wrong with having majority vote? Why not just have the majority pick the president of the United States? Why do we want to have this rather complicated, cumbersome process of the Electoral College? And, of course, this is seminal to an understanding of the way our founding fathers felt about limiting the power of the federal authority over government. Why don't you explain why the Electoral College really was such an ingenious idea?
Because they knew that a mob of people, that is, if you get just majority vote, you can have people swayed by those who have power financially, or you know, basically can buy votes these days through advertising and so on.
Hold that thought there for just a moment, David. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and we're talking about the Electoral College, why the Electoral College was so important, why the indirect election of senators was so important. In fact, why our country was set up as a republic and not as a democracy. And I think it's so important people understand that that our founding fathers were students of ancient civilizations. They understood what had happened in Greece and what had happened to their democracy, where you had majority rule. They understood what had happened to Rome, which began as a republic and then became a mobocracy and a dictatorship. And it was at the time when our founding fathers were working on the Constitution that there was a Scotch historian named Andrew Tyler, Professor Andrew Tyler, and he had studied, of course, the ancient civilizations as well, and he had written in his book on ancient Greece and ancient Rome that democracies are temporary forms of government. They last only until the people find they can vote themselves into the public treasury, and when they do, of course, they vote for the politicians who promises to give them the most. The government provides everything for everybody, and of course, eventually goes bankrupt, and government is replaced by dictatorship. That was what they knew a couple of hundred years ago, so they didn't want the people electing the senators. They wanted them to represent the states, because the checks and balance had not only to do with the executive, legislative, judicial parts of our government, each one balancing the other, but the balancing the power between the federal and the state government, and the states were to be strong, the central government was to be weak. Now, they never teach this in school anymore. Right. They never teach the idea that liberty and limited government are synonymous. They never tell you what the founding fathers said, and those who wrote in the Federalist Papers, and in the 45th of the Federalist Papers, you'll find the idea the powers of the government, federal government, should be limited and defined. The powers of the state government should be unlimited and ill-defined. In other words, everything having to do with life, liberty, and property will take place there. And the Electoral College was, of course, to give more power to the states, mm-hmm. and limited the power of the central authority, and the great tragedy is we never teach that in school today. Why the president can do anything that he wants to do. After all, this is a democracy, and I would defy any of our listeners to look anywhere in the Constitution and see the word democracy used, or in the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights, and the only places it mentions democracy, and even in the Federalist Papers, is to decry this concept. The last thing our founding fathers wanted was a democracy. Then why is it this is taught in school? Why? Because the wicked people have taken over our schools, over our media, they've taken over our government, and of course they are actually totally destroying these concepts that once made our government the envy of the whole world. And I'll keep quiet and you pick it up there, David.
That's right. Well, you're absolutely right. The Electoral College is a check on the federal power by the states. In addition, the Electoral College protects the smaller states, because you see a state like Alaska or Rhode Island or some other states that only have, if they didn't have three in the Electoral College, they would have very little, next to no say at all. And all the person running for president would have to do is go to the heavily populated states, California and Texas and Florida and New York, I believe was on that list previously. All they'd have to do is pay attention to those few states with the large population. They ignore the rest of the country, whereas was jokingly, but I think seriously, said by the liberal elites, oh yeah, the flyover territory, you know, the rest of America in between the important places. And in order to give the rural, thinly populated, the smaller states equal protection, they design the Electoral College in that regard. And so if no candidate receives a majority, then the House would choose the president, each state casting one vote as a majority of that state's congressman desired, and then the Senate would actually choose the vice president, one vote per senator, and that would take place. So we have never in the history of our nation yet had the Electoral College go to Congress, that the Congress would decide the president and vice president, although we've had some close calls, such as the 2000 election. Well, the qualifications for president, he must be a natural-born citizen. That is, if he was born in another country, he could not and cannot become president. He has to be at least 35 years old and a resident of the United States for at least the last 14 years. In other words, they didn't want someone who was heavily influenced by foreign thought or was born and therefore perhaps loyal to a foreign government and not to his own. And Dr. Stan, you've mentioned before the secret societies and the grave danger they pose, because the people who belong to those secret societies, and by the way, both current major party candidates belong to the Skull and Bones, which is another one of those secret societies, you have to question, where is their loyalty? Is their loyalty truly to our nation, or is it to this secret agenda of those secret organizations? Well, the process of secession, that is, if the president died, the vice president would succeed the president, and that process beyond the vice president, if both the president and vice president died, was changed in 1951 and later in 1967. So when we look at those amendments, the 22nd and 25th Amendment, we'll address the condition today in which secession would take place from the vice president and on down. Then Section 2 of Article 2 speaks of the powers and the duties of the president. And by the way, the president is to take an oath. Many people think, falsely so, and they've been lied to, that there's no religious, no Christian references in the Constitution. It's a purely secular document, this kind of garbage. Well, here we're told that the president is to take an oath. What is an oath? You look it up in your dictionary and you find out an oath is a solemn vow made before Almighty God. It's not a promise to the people who put them in office. It's not a promise to senators or congressmen or judges. It's a vow to Almighty God, which means Almighty God on the day of judgment is going to hold the president accountable to the vow that he made to, and the president's oath is to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution.
In fact, the president always swears that oath on a Bible.
That's right.
You see, the whole purpose of those people who would enslave us, who would take away our freedom, is to destroy the Christian foundation of this country, to poo-poo the idea that there's a religious foundation, and then, of course, to attack Christianity and Judaism, and they're doing a great job of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they had to take God out of our schools and prayer out of our schools and the Ten Commandments out of our schools, because once, of course, you take God's foundation from society, then you can replace it with tyranny. That's what it's all about. They know exactly what they're doing, but they don't want the American people to know.
And we want to spread this best-kept secret far and wide so Americans will understand and rise up and take back our nation from the pagans who are in power and take us back to a constitutional republic. Well, George Washington, the first president, of course, to use that oath to preserve and protect and defend the Constitution, on his own added the words, "So help me God," giving us an indication of his heart and his commitment. And that has started a tradition that every president since then has also added to that oath, "So help me God," to fulfill that promise that he made before God. The powers and duties of the president, he's the commander-in-chief of the Army and the Navy, and of all the state militias when those state militias are actually called into federal service. And his power over the armed forces is a power that's actually shared, and our founding fathers were extremely wise in this. They did not want the power of war solely in the hands of one person. The Congress is the one that makes the basic rules for armed forces, what's called the military code of uniform code of military justice. But the president is the one who gives the day-to-day orders and the more specific regulations as the commander-in-chief. Now, the states actually control the militias except when those militias are called up into federal service. Now, later on, we've already seen it in Article 1, it is Congress who is the body charged with the power to declare war. The commander-in-chief, the president, is not to declare war. That decision is to be made by the deliberative body, the Congress, and then the president is to execute their decision as the chief executive, the commander-in-chief of the Army. Well, today that has been undermined severely. Started back in 1973 with a War Powers Resolution, which further eroded the distinction in terms of what the president was restricted to do, according to our Constitution. And that, it was further eroded here in the Iraq War, when Congress basically capitulated and gave the president not the power to declare war. They weren't so bold as to make an outright violation of the Constitution that people would easily recognize, and yet they gave the power to go to war to the president in an unconstitutional fashion. They don't have the power to yield up what is restricted to themselves and yield it over to the president. There was a wall of a division of powers between the president and the Congress that was established with great wisdom on the part of our founding fathers. Then the president is to administer the departments over which he oversees, and therefore appoint the cabinet officials that advise him and administrate those departments that they oversee. And the president is granted the power to pardon offenses, all federal offenses, with the exception of impeachment and contempts, he could pardon. We saw Clinton abuse this power in a gross fashion at the close of his presidency.
Not only that, but of course, something could have been done by the next president. I mean,
Clinton
stole things from the White House. They pardoned people, in return for favors and for money. And of course, when the Bush administration came in, they said, well, let's put that behind
all
us.
Right.
Let's move on. Instead of holding Bill Clinton, who was really guilty of many criminal activities, that was probably stealing things from the White House. It was simply one of the petty little things he did. Pardoning criminals. There was a gentleman whose wife had given, I don't know how many million dollars to one of the Clinton foundations. So he pardoned her husband. There's no question.
Mm-hmm.
This was... that was payment for services granted or for money received. And yet, where was the outcry? Where was the outcry from the Christian church? Where was the outcry from Christian leaders? As long as George Bush didn't want to do anything about it, why, of course, we wouldn't be critical. And I think we've sort of lost our moorings. We've lost our foundation. We've lost our Christian basis. We'll be back here in just a moment to continue this discussion. Welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, go ahead, David. We were talking then about the Article 2 of the Constitution and the powers of the President of the United States. We were talking about his ability to pardon people. Of course, he's supposed to pardon them because, as an act of mercy or something, mm-hmm. but certainly not in return for getting money as Bill Clinton did.
Right, as a payoff. And in addition to pardoning offenses, he may make treaties, but that's with the concurrence of two-thirds of the senators have to vote to say, yes, that treaty will be ratified. The House was not involved in this because the framers thought this would jeopardize the executive secrecy that is often necessary in making a treaty. John Jay referenced that idea in Federalist 64. And the court, however, the Supreme Court, has created exceptions to this. And these exceptions, again, are in their essence unconstitutional. The court has basically said that commercial treaties don't require a majority. They require a simple majority of both houses, not the two-thirds of the senators.
Now, is this something like NAFTA or World Trade Organization?
All of those.
Right.
Right. And the one that's coming down the pike at us right now, the Free Trade Area of the Americas, all of these are now easily gotten through by the president because they do not require the two-thirds of the senators to ratify these treaties, and the court created these exceptions unconstitutionally.
But I think it's so important that our listeners understand why this was done. Now, you mm-hmm. can go back to an article written in April of 1973 in Foreign Affairs Magazine, which is published by America's Invisible Government. That's Foreign Affairs Magazine, April 1973, an article written by Richard Gardner, a Rhodes Scholar, member of the Council on Foreign Relations, but a member of the ruling elite. And, of course, he was talking about how we had to do an end run around mm-hmm. the Constitution so that we could give up our sovereignty, go into this world government, which is basically a world dictatorship under the ruling elite, the one that Plato had written about and cherished. But the whole idea was, as he said in that article, that what we'll have to do is do it through these treaties like GATT, General Agreement for Tariff and Trade, the World Trade Organization, the Law of the Sea Treaty, using these treaties, of course, to circumvent the Constitution and of course, destroy American sovereignty. They realized that they were violating the law, but they figured they'd get away with it. And with the help of the people, the politicians placed upon our Supreme Court, who were not interpreting the Constitution, but a part of this charade to destroy America and take us into the world order, the new world order, the new world economic system, the new world currency, and the new world religion. Why this Supreme Court justices have violated their oath to uphold the Constitution. And, of course, they are moving America, along with the rest of the world, at least other judges and other organizations throughout the world, into this one-world government, which I believe, of course, will be the government of the Antichrist.
That's exactly right.
Pick up the story there, David.
Well, in addition to making treaties, the president has the power to appoint Supreme Court justices, as well as ambassadors and other major federal officers, with the advice and the consent of Senate majority. And here the idea is that the Senate weighs in, approving of those. And we see again with the kind of filibuster of the president's judicial nominees that the filibuster is a complete violation of the intent of the Constitution here, where a small minority, not the majority of the Senate, but a small minority of the Senate can hold up the entire process and just stonewall it forever. Well,
in other words, what you're saying is that the filibuster allows the senators to keep the judges from being appointed.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And
we'll be right back here in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and we're going through Article 2 of the Constitution. David Whitney is talking about, first of all, that the president has the ability to negotiate treaties, but he has to have the support of two-thirds of the Senate, not the House of Representatives, but two-thirds of the Senate, to ratify a treaty. But, of course, the Supreme Court has held well on things like NAFTA and GATT and World Trade Organization. Those are commercial treaties, so they don't need the two-thirds support. Why? Because these are leading us into the world government and the destruction of our national sovereignty. And then, of course, David was talking about how the president is to appoint Supreme Court justices. But of course, we find now, of course, that a very small minority, not a, the whole idea was with the majority of the people in the Senate, he could have, appoint whoever he wanted to the United States Senate. But now, using the filibuster and then all these other tricks, why a very small number of people in the Senate have been able to block the appointment of responsible judges, people who believed in the Constitution rather than those who were intent upon the coming establishing a dictatorship in America. Mm-hmm.
That's right. So that's Section 2 of Article 2, and then Section 3 goes on to speak of the powers and ceremonial duties that the President is to give information to Congress. And traditionally, although not set down in stone or any legal force, traditionally he has given an annual State of the Union address to the Congress, and at other such times as Congress may require, he's to give them information and recommend legislation. Now, it's important to note that the President never introduces legislation. Someone in Congress must introduce it, but he can suggest ideas. He can also convene emergency sessions of Congress. Now, we need to remember that when the Constitution was formed, the whole intent was that Congress would not be in session year-round. This was a part-time job, if you would think of it that way, that for a number of months, maybe 3 or 4 months of the year, the senators and congressmen representing their states and their districts would assemble in Washington, D.C., and then when they would recess, they would be recessed for the majority of the year. And it's a great evil that now we have a full-time Congress, because we know that most of what they do in their full-time, 90-some percent of it, is unconstitutional.
Well, I think what's so important is to realize that the Constitution spelled out certain specific and limited things that the Congress and could do. And then, of course, the Tenth Amendment stated that any powers not specifically given to the Congress by the states, by the Constitution, is to be limited to the states and to the people. Mm-hmm. In other words, limitations on what the power of the federal could do, government could do, limited to those things that have been specifically stipulated in the Constitution. Why? Because our founding fathers feared Congress would take away our freedom, would pass all sorts of legislation that would restrict the power of the individual. And that's exactly what's happened.
That is so. And I like the humorous statement that Mark Twain made, and this was, over 100 years ago. He said that there is no native criminal class in the United States except the Congress.
No, I think another thing that he said was no man's purse or property are safe when Congress is in session.
That's exactly right.
And, of course, Congressman Ron Paul said that the day that the Congress does the most for the American people is the day of the House Republican-Democrat baseball game, because they're not in session. And people must understand most of what they do is absolute mischief.
Yes, and it's a because most of what they do is not permissible under the Constitution given to us by our founding fathers. In other words, they're violating their oath of office. And again, the President, much of what he does, 90-plus percent of what he does, is unconstitutional. Just take his No Child Left Behind thing. Well, there's no constitutional provision whatsoever to spend one thin dime of the taxpayers' dollars on education at the federal level. Not one bit. So that's completely unconstitutional. And when a president or a congressman or senator or judge violate their oath of office, they are to be impeached and removed from office for violating that. And yet we see that they continue on, and that's because Americans are ignorant about what the Constitution says and therefore are unable to hold their elected officials accountable.
Well, let me tell you a little story. The only time I met George Bush, I was at a meeting in Washington, D.C., and we each had a question to ask. And this man sitting next to me, his name is John Stormer, and John said to, at that time, Governor Bush, Governor, if you were the President of the United States, and a bill was given to you, presented to you, passed both the House and the legislature on education or labor, and it was unconstitutional, would you sign it? And George Bush, who today is the president, sat there and he said, after about a minute, he said, I don't understand the question. So George, John repeated, he said, well, let's make it simpler. It has to do with education. The bill has to do with education. It is unconstitutional. Would you sign that legislation that was unconstitutional? And George W. Bush hesitated for a moment, and he said, I'm going to have to think about that. And he came up afterwards, and he said, that was a great question. I'm going to go home and think about that. A little wonder we're in the problems we are today. We'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is David Whitney, Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. We're talking about the foundations of our freedom, this understanding that there are things that are constitutional, there are things that are unconstitutional, and tragically, most of the people in Washington, D.C. either don't believe in our Constitution, or they don't understand our Constitution, or they don't understand that they've sworn before God that they'll uphold the Constitution. You'd never know they'd made that sworn, oath, because, of course, they're violating that literally on a daily basis, and they're able to get away with it because the average individual doesn't understand the Constitution. And with that as a background, David, pick up the story.
Yes, and just let me mention that that's what Institute on the Constitution has been formed for, to educate Americans all across our nation by the millions, so that people will be able to rise up and throw the people out of office who refuse to obey the Constitution and only place people in office who will follow the Constitution. So as we're going through the course here, people can obtain the entire course by calling us at 1-866-730-9796. That's 1-866-730-9796. Or they can actually order our host kit on the web at iotconline.com.
All right, as long as we're talking about that, there is an Institute of the Constitution being held in Salinas every Saturday morning for the next 4 or 5 weeks. And if you're out there in the listening audience, you really need to get more information. You need to be able to acquaint yourself with the Constitution so you can discuss it intelligently, and there's no better way than to attend the meetings of the Institute of the Constitution. Let me suggest you call 877-448-5798. That's 877-448-5798.
Well, you know, the Section 4 of Article 2 speaks of impeachment, a very important principle, and applies not just to the president, but to the vice president and to all civil officers. And impeachment is to be on grounds of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. And we had quite a debate going on here with the impeachment of Bill Clinton, whether his Lewinsky escapades qualified as high crimes and misdemeanors. But Dr. Stan, you and I know that that was just a convenient charade to distract our attention from what was really taking place, the treasonous behavior of the president in selling our military secrets to the Chinese in order to get cash for his reelection campaign. He was a treasonous traitor of the worst sort, and of course nobody ever mentioned anything like that being the cause for a possible or probable impeachment.
Travelgate, Rangate, Fostergate, Browngate, all of those, Chinagate. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and our guest is Pastor David Whitney. David, I want you to give your telephone number again, telling our listeners out across America how they can get in touch with the Institute of the Constitution and set up an Institute of the Constitution in their area.
Yes, we encourage everyone, everywhere. It's very easy. It's a turnkey system. It doesn't take any training on your part to show the videos and to help your class walk through a series of discussion questions, and we give you the answers. Our phone number at Institute on the Constitution is 1-866-730-9796. That's 1-866-730-9796. Or you can order on the web through iotconline.com.
All right, fine. And I recommend this training program to everybody there in the listening audience. It's so vital, so essential that you understand the foundations of our freedom so you can help teach it to others. And so we're going through step by step Article 2 of the Constitution, which, of course, empowers the president and what he can specifically do. Is there anything else in Article 2 that
we
should talk about?
The procedure for impeachment is important, that the House actually votes to impeach, and a majority is required. And so when the House votes and they succeed in obtaining a majority, then that individual has been impeached. There was some confusion, I think, in many people's minds, thinking, well, Bill Clinton wasn't impeached because he wasn't removed from office. Well, there's a two-step process. The first step is impeachment by a vote of the majority of the House. The second step, then, is the Senate holds basically a trial and votes to remove the individual from office. It requires two-thirds of the vote of the Senate to actually remove him, which is why Bill Clinton continued in office. Two-thirds were not able to have the... it just seems outrageous to me that they couldn't see and vote to impeach him, but we know there was other things going on behind the scenes away from the public eye. Well, Bill Clinton's not the only president that's been impeached. In 1868, the House impeached Andrew Johnson, but he also, one vote short, was not achieved to get a two-thirds majority of the House, the Senate, to remove him. And then in 1974, we remember that Richard Nixon resigned. He actually wasn't impeached, but the House was at that point preparing articles of impeachment for him. And then impeachment has only been used on the federal level 11 other times, and those included 9 judges, 1 senator, 1 cabinet official, and oddly enough, the Senate acquitted all but 4 of those, so there's only been successful impeachments in the terms of actually removing the person from office in the case of 4 judges over the course of 200 and some odd years of our constitutional republic, and I dare say, Dr. Stan, we need a lot more impeachments.
I think we do as well. And, Christian, what's really so interesting is that one of those judges who was impeached for taking bribes actually is the man who is going to be leading the United Nations team that's coming in to supervise our elections. It is this impeached judge who's going to be actually leading this impartial committee coming from the United Nations. Doesn't it make you feel warm and fuzzy?
Yes. What crooks get back into positions of power? And all of this, of course, was designed to be a legislative check upon the executive power and also to promote stability by providing an orderly means of removing corrupt officials from office without bloodshed, riots, or even a civil war. In Article 3, of course, we come to the judicial branch. And oddly enough, the judicial branch was one that our founding fathers thought would have very little to do almost because it was very restricted in its powers. And they basically saw that the Supreme Court was not going to have a great deal of power at all. They didn't worry about it, which unfortunately they perhaps should have, because today the Supreme Court almost is the ruling oligarchy in our land. 9 lawyers in black robes can speak the word, and that becomes the law of the land, irregardless of whether it's constitutional or unconstitutional.
And, of course, Thomas Jefferson foresaw that, and we actually have this wonderful quotation where he talks about, you know, he sees within the federal judiciary the seeds of disillusion of our form of government for a small group working as a thief by night, taking a little here, a little there, until all power shall be centralized in Washington, D.C., and we shall have a government as venal as that from which we were just recently separated. Now, Thomas Jefferson wrote that 200 years ago. He foresaw what would happen with it when you had corrupt people on the Supreme Court. And ladies and gentlemen, we have corrupt people on the Supreme Court. But what is so unconscionable is that 7 of those were nominated by Republican presidents. And I've been a lifelong Republican. But when you begin to understand that the truth of the matter is there's not a dime's worth of difference between the leaders of both political parties, then you begin to understand why 7 of those corrupt judges on the Supreme Court were nominated by Republicans. And I'm not saying that the Democrats would have done any better. Mm-hmm. All I'm saying is that if you believe in the myth of the two-party system, you probably still believe in the tooth fairy.
Well, the judicial power permanently resides in the judiciary, only in the Supreme Court. That is, all the lower federal courts, the circuit courts and so on, they all are established or can be disestablished by the Congress. Again, the legislative check on the judicial power is very clear here. And the Congress could abolish any of those lower federal courts or even at additional levels. Now, most people think that judges are appointed and they're in their position for life. That is not constitutional. The Constitution says the judges hold office during good behavior. And what they meant by that, of course, is if they will abide by their oath, and their oath is to uphold the Constitution and never to pass a decision that's unconstitutional. Well, we see hundreds of those decisions these days.
Well, I think what it was so interesting, though, is that the Congress has the right to limit the appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, and they have been doing that. Tom Daschle didn't want the Supreme Court interfering with something having to do with firefighting and the EPA up in his state, and so he got legislation through that limited the appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court having to do with fires or whatever it was, the EPA jurisdiction in the his own state. And, of course, recently, why the House of Representatives passed legislation that limited the Supreme Court's ability to act on the Defense of Marriage Act, which, of course, said that marriage was an institution between one man and one woman, not between Adam and Eve, but not between Adam and Steve, but between Adam and Eve, as it were. So this can be done. I don't know what the Senate has done with that legislation, but certainly the House passed that. So our leaders know that they can limit the power of the Supreme Court. It is simply that they will not do it on the important issues, such as abortion. In fact, the latest issue is the average Christian out there does not realize that the Partial Birth Abortion Act, which was passed, and the Christians were out there in the audience are clapping, and isn't this wonderful? The Partial Birth Abortion Act, which the Congress and the Senate passed and the President signed, codified into law Roe versus Wade and abortion on demand in America. Immediately, the Supreme Court struck down the partial birth abortion part of the bill, but let's stand the fact that our elected legislators voted to codify into law Roe versus Wade abortion on demand. I bet there's not one in 1,000 Christians out there who's heard that through regular channels, because the information that has gotten to the Christians who are being manipulated today has been so carefully filtered by Karl Rove and the others who work closely with the media elite to control what the American people think.
And with that appellate jurisdiction, as you're referring to, if the Congress and Senate really wanted to prevent the Supreme Court from having anything to say about that bill that they passed, they could have easily added a line at the end to say, this is out of the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court can make no ruling on this piece of legislation. And very clearly, they chose not to do that because, as you mentioned, they, in other cases, are making such appellate jurisdiction restrictions. Again, the legislature was to have almost this great power over the Supreme Court because the Supreme Court's actual range of duties that it was able to judge on was very limited. It says all cases in law and equity arising under the Constitution, and this involved foreign officials or admiralty or maritime law, since, you know, it would be difficult for individual states to handle such matters, or controversies involved between states or involving citizens of a different nation and a state here, and or a suit between a state and a citizen of another nation, all those kind of things. In other words, it was a very narrow, restricted range of cases that the Supreme Court was to look at. As a matter of fact, the Supreme Court's basic design was to strike down any usurpation on the part of the Congress. That is, when Congress passed a piece of legislation that was outside of their constitutional jurisdiction, Article 1, Section 8. In other words, they passed something like No Child Left Behind. That's completely out of their jurisdiction, and the Supreme Court, if it functioned as it should, would strike such a piece of legislation down as unconstitutional, throw it out, and yet they have not done that since the time of Franklin D. Roosevelt, who attacked the Supreme Court.
And I think it was really so interesting that when FDR came in, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he passed a number of pieces of legislation known as the New Deal. The NRA was specifically one of them, the National Recovery Act. And these were hardcore socialist, communist pieces of legislation aimed at centralizing power in Washington, D.C., and usurping authority that belonged to the states that the federal government had no right to do. And the Supreme Court struck down that legislation, even though it was passed by the Congress and the Senate and signed by the President, and the Supreme Court said, you don't have the right to do that. And, of course, that was when President Roosevelt announced he was going to pack the court. He was going to put on an additional 9 people on the court, double the number of Supreme Court justices. And, of course, there was such an uproar across America even from people who supported President Roosevelt, because he was usurping power and people could see we were moving towards a dictatorship, that he had to back down. But what he did do was not add people to the court. He simply put people under the Supreme Court who did not believe in the Constitution. In fact, almost all of them were members of a secret society that was aimed at destroying the fabric of our society. And if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get that and understand there really are secret societies, and they controlled our Supreme Court as we began moving from being a republic to a democracy and now towards a dictatorship.
So at that point was basically the last time the Supreme Court seriously functioned as it's supposed to function, as a check on the legislative process. When the legislature proposes something unconstitutional, the Supreme Court was supposed to strike it down. They have not done so since the days of FDR. Instead, they have trained their guns, and I use that term advisedly, they have trained their guns on the powers that the states were granted by the Constitution, or actually were reserved to the states. As you mentioned earlier, Federalist 45 said, you know, very restricted power to the federal government, very large and unrestricted powers to the state governments. Well, in order to accomplish this coup in which the one world government will be established and our freedoms are taken away, they recognized they had to destroy the strong states and centralize power in Washington, D.C. And that's what the Supreme Court has been functioning, completely opposite to what it was designed to do by our founding fathers. Now, one of the important notes in Section 2 of Article 3 is that there is a right to trial by jury preserved for all federal crimes except impeachment, and the trial shall be in the state where the crime was allegedly committed. And the jury of common citizens was an important check, again, upon the abuse of government power by judges and prosecutors. One of the things that most Americans don't know is that they have three votes. The one they think of is the one they cast November, the ballot box, and so on. But there's two additional votes, and those are the vote on a grand jury or a petit jury. And those are extremely important because our founding fathers understood that a jury basically is the last bulwark against tyranny. That a jury, a fully informed jury that understands their calling and the design that they placed, that our founding fathers placed them in, could be a check upon evil legislation. Even if a piece of legislation passed Senate and House, signed by the President, approved by the Supreme Court, no question, it flew through, yet in a trial, a jury could say, this law is unconstitutional, therefore this man, this woman accused is not guilty, because no matter what evidence the state presents, the law itself on its face is unconstitutional. We throw it out. And yet today, every judge will tell the jury they do not have that right that our founding fathers established. They'll tell them, you can decide the facts of a case, but you must not decide whether the law is constitutional or unconstitutional. And that is a tyrannical judiciary has crept in and established themselves as a rotten core to this evil system that's seeking to establish itself in world government.
Well, we've got Paul calling us from Michigan. Paul, do you have a question for our guest?
Speaking of that, Dr.
Do you have a question?
Yes. Why couldn't the judges of the Supreme Court be held elected by the real people and then restricted with term limits?
Well, of course, because this is not constitutional. You would have to change the entire Constitution to do that.
And the design of the Constitution was to protect judges at that level from being influenced by political pressure. Gouverneur Morris, who's called the penman of the Constitution, he said, those who are charged with the important duties of administering justice should, if possible, depend only on God. They wanted the godly, God-fearing men who really were not going to be swayed by political pressure, and that's why they constructed the system they did in terms of our judiciary.
So I think, Phil, that this was a system that worked, and it worked very, very well for 250 years until, of course, wicked people circumvented the whole concept that were laid out there and began packing our courts with people who didn't believe in our Constitution but wanted an all-powerful government. But if you think things would be any better if they were elected by the people, after all, look and see what we get when we have majority rule.
Mm, OK. Okay. Now, what about the congressionally granted privilege of executive orders?
You mean in terms of the president?
Right. This is being. Why don't you just discuss that? Because I think it's an important issue. What we have is the executive expanding powers for things that were never anticipated. Executive orders, my understanding, were simply for administrative issues, and suddenly they've gone so far as actually to have the power to restrict the freedom of everybody in the name of a national emergency. Then they keep calling national emergencies. And if you'd like, we have an article we offer free of charge to anybody who'd like it. 1972, when several senators were talking about how, of course, they had circumvented the Constitution. But thanks so very much for calling. I think that's a very, very good point.
It is, because the executive orders, when they're done correctly, will always be constitutional. In other words, any executive order given which is in violation of the president's oath of office to defend and protect and uphold the Constitution, if it's unconstitutional, on its face, it's illegal, and he has violated his oath of office and should be impeached.
We have a great four tapes on the War Powers Act, and if any of our listeners would like to learn how to get that four tape set, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. But along with that, you'll get a copy of a Senate report that was put out over the name of Senator Frank Church and one or two others, and they were really expressed their concern back in 1972 that we were moving from freedom towards dictatorship. We'll be back in just a moment to finalize this program this evening. Well, Pastor Whitney, we've just got a couple of minutes more. Let's get your telephone number out just one more time.
It's 1-866-730-9796. That's 1-866-730-9796. And they can also get a hold of us on the web at iotconline.com. And the final section of the Section 3 is dealing with treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. And we've been talking tonight about quite a few people who are in office that are not just giving aid to the enemy, they are the enemy. And they should not only be impeached, they should be put on trial for treason. And, I like the days when they treated treasonous people in the proper sense. They hung them from the yardarm. And there's quite a few treasonous persons within our government today that need to be given that treatment, I believe.
Well, of course, the thing is that we're told that people swear to defend our Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And nobody ever asks who those domestic enemies are.
Mm-hmm.
We've got an awful lot in the legislature who don't believe in our form of government, who really want a dictatorship that will provide for the people and control the people from the cradle to the grave. And, of course, they're going to be the controllers.
And the interesting thing in this section is the United States is referred to in the plural. These United States, that sense, and it indicates our founding fathers really understood that each of the states entering this confederation through the Constitution were sovereign nations of their own. They were coming together to share powers and to do things they could not do on their own, but they were still sovereign nations on their own. And of course, the war between the states virtually destroyed that. And ever since the war between the states, the powers of the states have been continually eroded and to a point that is almost unrecognizable. I think our founding fathers, if they were to look at our system of government today, would say, this looks nothing like what they created, nothing like what they envisioned at all.
And I think it's so important to understand that at the time of the Civil War, it was not about slavery. They did not pass the Emancipation Proclamation until 1863, well into the war.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, they freed the slaves in the area of the South that they had no control over, and they left the slaves who were in North and border states, who they could have emancipated and freed, they left them in slavery. It had nothing to do with that. It had to do with, of course, centralizing all power in Washington, D.C. David, we're out of time. Thank you so very much for being with us. We'll look forward to having you back again next month as we go through step by step an understanding of the greatest document that's given the most freedom to any nation throughout all history. God bless you too, David. Good night. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when, of course, we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. We depend on those of you who listen to us to help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every day on radio someplace, 5 hours every day on the Internet. You can actually hear our Internet programs. You can set up cables from your computer or to a speaker in your kitchen or in your workshop or in your office, or you can get a little headset from Radio Shack, and you can walk any place in the house and actually hear the programs that we have many people doing. And I don't suggest you listen 5 hours a day, although we appreciate those people who do. We really want you, of course, to spend your time getting educated and then helping us educate others as we reach out with an understanding not only the fact that America was founded as a republic, that we are a unique nation throughout the world. We were founded as a Christian and constitutional republic, but more than that, there are secret societies that work within our nation today. And if you don't believe that, you need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You ought to get that tape set we were talking about a little earlier called the War Powers Act, and ask for the article that comes with that. It was a report came out of the Senate over the names of Frank Church and one other United States senator who back in 1972 were concerned about the fact we were moving rapidly towards dictatorship. And then, of course, we hope many of you out there will want to get our video, They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll, either the 4 or the 10-hour version. That's They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll, the 4 or the 10-hour version. Why is that important as you get the video and watch it? Because, of course, they have been using music and everything else that is aimed at destroying the moral fabric of our society to bring about the New World Order, the New World Religion, the New World Tyranny. This is really what it's all about. I think this is an excellent, excellent video. This is why we offer it through our ministry. And then, of course, if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to. If you really want to understand how they're poisoning our children, you need to get our 4 tapes out on mercury, or on aspartame, or on water fluoridation, or on vaccination. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, they are poisoning our children. They know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want you to know. Have you noticed there's an epidemic of cancer in our nation today? Why is there so much cancer? We didn't have this much cancer 30 years ago, 50 years ago when I went through medical school. Well, I'll tell you, there's a reason for it. You need to get our 4-tape set called The New Order of the Barbarians, where in 1969, the head of Planned Parenthood, the medical director of Planned Parenthood, Dr. Richard Day, laid the whole incredible story out. And if you've never heard the 4-tape set, The New Order of the Barbarians, you need to get it. Now, you can get a transcript with that as well, and the information you'll find will be fascinating. So let me suggest that you order the 4-tapes set, The New Order of the Barbarians, and get the information, help us disseminate it across the nation. It's very rarely when somebody on the inside admits everything going on. Of course, my latest newsletter, and that's the September newsletter, we'll be glad to send you one free of charge if you call us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Why, of course, our new newsletter simply quotes Bertrand Russell, who is part of this secret elite group, and of course, we take his quotations from his book, The Impact of Science on Society, where he talks about how they will control the minds of the people by diet and injections. Shucks, how are they going to control us through diet and injections? Well, you need to get our 4-tape set on aspartame and on mercury and fluoride. They know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want you to know. We hope many of you want to come to our November 6th all-day-long meeting here, Saturday, November 6th, at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We're going to be serving lunch. We need to know how many are coming. We're bringing in outside speakers. It should be a great time. And, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival, pray for our boys who are dying over in Iraq, and pray for the Iraqi people, too. And pray for America that God may hold back his judgment on this nation. Until tomorrow at the same time, or Monday, may the Lord be with you. Hale. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Ron Brown. And Ron, of course, is Sports Radio Liberty. And we want to talk him a little bit about what's happening on the financial field across America, across the world. Certainly one of my favorite columnists is Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, who's an economist. He writes regular articles in the Washington Times. In fact, as I go through the editorial pages of the Washington Times on a daily basis, there are only a couple of people that really have something really worthwhile and novel to say. Oh, there are a lot of good columnists. Certainly Cal Thomas is there. But Arnold de Borgrave is excellent. He's certainly used to be the senior editor of Newsweek magazine, but he was too honest to hold the job. But Dr. Paul Craig Roberts has such a great grasp of what's going on today. And in one of his recent articles, he was talking about the fact that if President Bush and John Kerry really understood the implications of what is about to happen during the next administration, they wouldn't be competing to see who would be get elected. They would be vying to throw the election, each one trying to throw the election, because it doesn't matter who gets elected. The next administration is going to be swept away in chaos. And then he goes to talk about how, of course, we're outsourcing our jobs. We're getting rid of the jobs here in America. How can you have a recovery when there's an organized effort to send the good-paying jobs out of America? And the new jobs that are being formed are domestic jobs, are hamburger jobs. They are not manufacturing jobs, and they're not good-paying jobs. Our factories are leaving. Our wealth is leaving. We have the greatest deficits of all time. This last quarter, the trade deficit was $166 billion. Now, they're talking about a $500 billion or half a trillion dollar trade deficit this year, but it's anticipated that we may very well actually have a deficit that may be even higher than that if you were to carry out that $166 billion quarterly deficit. Why, you'd be getting closer to $600 billion, and it certainly will be that next year unless something happens. And then, of course, we have the federal deficit, the budget deficit. They admit to $422 billion, but they don't tell you about the other $200 billion they've stolen from Social Security and Medicare. The Republicans have done it. The Democrats have done it. It's just that the American people don't understand that there is no money in the Social Security or Medicare trust fund. It's all been spent by the politicians of today to buy the support of the people so they can remain in office, totally ignoring the fact that someday this is going to have to be paid. We did an interview this last week or so ago with Professor Kiplikoff, who is the chairman of the Department of Economics at Boston University, and in his new book, The Coming Intergenerational Storm, he talked about the fact that our real deficit is not a $4 or $5 or $10 billion. It's $72 trillion. This is $72 trillion that we owe to take care of the Social Security and Medicare obligations we have, and we have no plan or no possible way ever to pay that off. America is totally bankrupt. We're morally bankrupt, but we're economically bankrupt. And with that as the background, Ron Brown, tell us your thoughts on what's going on.
I think you gave a good description of what's going on. And to put it into more simple terms, you know, if you think about it, our whole monetary system is really a debt-based or credit-based system. So that being the case, the system must continue to grow so you can continue to...
Hold that thought.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. And go ahead, Ron. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but we just had to let some of our stations go for a moment. Pick up the story there.
Okay, so they must keep the system growing. The economy must grow. The money in circulation must grow. And so it really kind of becomes a confidence game. But if you'll notice, every time something tries to collapse in the system, and I was reading an article, and it said recent history is replete with federal engineered bailouts, from the Continental Illinois Bank and the Penn Central crashing back in 1987, the stock market. Remember the savings and loans industry that was crashing in the 1980s? The Mexican peso tried to collapse in 94. They had to bail that out. Then you had the Asian crisis of 1997. And then most people might not have heard long-term capital management. One of these massive hedge funds was going bankrupt, so they had to bail that out. The point being is the system must grow, so I'm convinced, and I kind of say this facetiously, but if Greenspan called Bush today and said, Monday we have to have a joint session of Congress, and by noon we need to vote in $1 trillion to bail out the pension plan or whatever else is failing, I guarantee it would be done, because to not do so would to allow the system to implode into a 29-style banking panic. Of course, the debt's so much greater now compared to what it was then that the results would be absolutely devastating. So they cannot allow it to happen.
Okay. Well, of course, I think it's so important that people really understand that, you know, we really have real problems here. And, of course, we're losing our manufacturing base. How can we stay on as a major society if we don't have a manufacturing base?
Yeah, how do you keep, you know, you hit it on the nose. How do you keep this debt structure growing when, one, we're outsourcing all of our jobs, so the people are making less money, people are getting laid off, and so it gets harder and harder to keep the system going because of what's going on. The real problem, of course, is that as you bail out everything, then you reduce or destroy the fear of failure, or the fear of a credit collapse, because everyone that's invested knows the government will always inflate it and bring it out. So people just keep going deeper and deeper into debt with the feeling that the government would not let them fail. And you hear that said all the time, you know, the government will not allow it to go into deflation.
Well, Chris, the thing is that there's no way the government is going to be able to prevent this without inflating the economy and, of course, destroying the value of the dollar. Now, of course, they have all of these safeguards supposedly in there, but they will only work just so long. And, of course, if you get overloaded with debt, as we are today, with the federal government by itself having $72 trillion in financial obligations and no way to pay them, our population as a whole certainly is surrounded by debt. And then, of course, we have a situation, with our states are massively in debt. Even here in California, San Diego has bankrupted itself by making pension promises to retiring employees. They can retire with 90% of pay and full health benefits, and they go out and get another job. But, of course, San Diego is going bankrupt. And as our municipalities, as our states, and even our federal government begin to go under, the only way out of this, of course, is to turn on the printing presses and inflate away the debts. And when you do that, of course, you end up destroying the currency.
Yeah, that's the other side of the coin. For every action, there is a reaction. So when the government starts the printing press rolling, then it devalues the currency, which becomes a vicious cycle. The more you devalue the currency, the more you have to print to keep the thing going. So I really believe we're heading towards, not the same thing, but something very similar to what happened in Germany in 1921.
Well, it's very interesting you say that. I was talking to Jim Poplava the other day. I don't know if you know who Jim is, but he's one of the sharpest economists we have out there, financial advisors. And he mentioned that he'd just taken a couple of months and he'd been researching what happened in the Weimar Republic. And, of course, he was very concerned the parallels between what happened in the Weimar Republic in the 1920s and, of course, early 1930s, and what's happening in America today.
Well, you know, in the Weimar Republic, it was right after World War I, and the Treaty of Versailles forced Germany to pay reparations to the victors. And Germany was they'd spent everything they had trying to fight the war, so they were broke. But they insisted on reparations, so what did Germany do? They just started a printing press to roll it out. And when you look at the figures, the figure I remember is that in 1919 or 1920, It took three German Reichsmarks to equal one U.S. dollar. 2-3 years later, it took 12 trillion Reichsmarks to equal one U.S. dollar. So what it did, obviously, was wipe out the middle class of Germany, which, as we know, set the stage for the savior to come in, and that happened to be Adolf Hitler.
And, of course, this has happened time and time again. Exactly the same thing happened in France in 1789, and we have a wonderful book we offer through my ministry called Fiat Money Inflation in France. It's the story of what happened in France in 1789, where they came up with a wonderful idea. We can create prosperity by printing money, and we'll back it. Of course, money has to have backing, so we'll bank it with the money that we've seized from the Catholic Church and the future revenues of the French government, and we're going to be able to get the economy moving and create prosperity. And they started printing paper money, and it worked well. I mean, everybody began to prosper. They had a stock market at that time, and the stock market boomed, and everybody was gaining. Well, I mean, these people who played the game were making money hand over fist, just like the people who play the game in our system today. But it's only a game. And then pretty soon, of course, prices began to rise, and, of course, the value of the currency then couldn't keep up with the rising prices, so they had to print more in the way of money to keep the economy going. It's sort of like a junkie. After one fix, he's got to have another fix, and then another one, and another one, and another one. And it wasn't very long before, of course, money lost its value. With this came a breakdown in the morals of the society. Marriage lost its meaning. Everybody was going to live high on the hog and this wonderful utopian world that they'd created. And within 10 years, they had a dictator. His name was Napoleon Bonaparte. Americans have forgotten the lessons of the past because they don't teach the lessons of history. But we have to remember those things, and we have a wonderful book called Fiat Money Inflation in France. We recommend that everybody get that book and read it, because what we're seeing today, even though they've kept this thing going really since 1971, August of 1971, when President Nixon took us off the gold standard, I believe we're coming rapidly approaching the point of no return.
Yeah, and see, our Treaty of Versailles in our society today is we have a welfare state that must be fed. And so the worse things get, the more you have to spend on the welfare, and so it just keeps growing and growing and growing. And the real dilemma, of course, is you have to become a speculator to survive, and the people who don't speculate, for example, the people who've been refinancing their houses and buying bigger houses and real estate values have been going up, they're feeling real happy with things the way they are right now. But the person who didn't get involved in the speculative game, the person who's trying to live off of the income on their CDs or their T-bills, is really starting to lose his purchasing power in place in society. So you reach the point where everyone can't keep up, and that's when things get out of control, and eventually the bubbles will start to implode on themselves.
What really amazes me, Ron, is how so few people really understand what's going on. So many people, and I know very, very sophisticated investors, are telling me, well, I'm invested in CDs, and I'm getting 2% now, or I'm invested in government bonds, I'm getting 4% now. But what they don't understand is that inflation is somewhere between 7 and 9%. And, of course, so they're losing 7 to 9% on the value of their money that they have invested. And not only that, but they're having to pay taxes on that 4% they're making. So they're going behind every single year, and you can only keep doing that for a certain period of time, and fortunes are wiped out. And, of course, as inflation becomes certainly more of a problem, and the only reason that they're raising the interest rates today is because Alan Greenspan and the people on the Federal Reserve System know what's going on. They've got to raise the interest rates to control the ravages of inflation, but they cannot tell the American people the truth, so they have to consistently lie about what's going on and say, oh, everything's looking good and there's a soft patch here, you know, but this is only temporary and everything's going to be fine and there really isn't any inflation at all. And, of course, the reason there's no inflation is because they juggle the figures. That's the old saying that figures don't lie, but liars can sure figure.
That's right. And the attempt to fight inflation, all the hype that goes around that, is really kind of a magician's trying to convince the world. Because remember, this whole thing is a confidence game. And if people ever perceive inflation as getting out of control, then they will start to invest differently. So So the Fed has to step in and pretend to be fighting interest rates when we know, anyone that follows knows, they cannot allow the system to contract. If you took interest rates up to 6%, for example, just to keep up with inflation, you would collapse the whole system. But he has to go through the motions of convincing people that he's serious about fighting inflation. Have you ever heard the saying that a politician is the only person who, when he's being led out of town to be tarred and feathered, will jump out in front and act like he's leading the parade? But that's basically what Greenspan is. He's not fighting inflation in the first place. Just raising interest rates doesn't fight inflation if you're running the printing press full blast.
And, of course, he's apparently turned out almost $1 trillion over the last year or so to try to stimulate the economy. And with everything he's done, he hasn't been able to stimulate the economy. The only thing they've been able to do is create a tremendous bubble in housing costs that have nothing to do with the cost of building that house and the real worth of the house. But it's really beginning to contract a little bit. As we look across the country, we find gradual early signs of contracting the price of housing. If you run into that at all, Ron, that it seems to be in certain parts of the country, we're getting sort of a little softer market?
Absolutely. I'll share the story with one client out in the California area that had called me, and his particular area or neighborhood, apparently it was a hot area, and wholesalers were coming in to buy up properties for big money to resell and fix it up and resell, and they came to him and offered him $850,000 for his 2,000 square foot house. And he called me and asked what he should do, and I said, this is not rocket science. But anyway, he failed to do that, and within about 3 months, just the hint of higher interest rates, remember a few months back when they were talking about interest rates going up, these wholesalers backed off, and all of a sudden that house dropped from $800,850 down to $600,650. So when this bubble pops on the real estate, and you just can't keep it going up forever and ever, because there's just so many distortions that come into the system that eventually it just runs its course, just like the dot-com bubble, remember, back in the 90s. Everyone thought it would go on forever, but the ones who stayed too late, some of them lost 60, 70, 80% of their money within a matter of months. So it's scary what could happen to the real estate when the bubble pops. It's just you never know when it will pop, Dr. Stan, because the monetary authorities have such a vested interest in keeping that bubble going. They'll pull rabbits out of their hat as long as they can to keep the system from imploding.
But, you know, I think the amazing thing, Ron, is with all of the manipulation of the stock market, and there's no question at all that the government is intervening illegally along with certain of the big banks and the certain big brokers and going in at the end of the day and buying up shares of stock to buoy this up, they still haven't been able to get this market moving at all prior to the election. I think that they have done everything they could to run the market up, hoping to get George Bush reelected with good times, economic times. The market's up, everybody's feeling good, because sir, many times our whole outlook on the world is simply a reflection of how well the Dow Jones Industrial Average is doing, and no matter how much they've intervened and how much they have violated the law to create the perception of a good and healthy economy, why, the market just isn't doing much of anything.
That's right. And, you know, if you think back to just April of this year, you had the Dow Jones threatening to break through 10,000 again, which is an absolute critical level that they maintain. You had the bond market down. You had oil price breaking above 40 for the first time. Do you need to take a break?
We got about 40 seconds. Go ahead, Ron.
Okay. And gold and silver were starting to reflect that inflation and the increase in the oil price and so forth. Gold was at 433, threatening to break through a major resistance and run towards 500. Silver was at 830, which was up 60-something percent in just a matter of months. And with 6 months to, or 7 months to go to the election, they had to do something to stop it. So they came in and just blasted all the markets, and they've been trying to hold it together for all these months. And I think after the election, you're going to see a lot of that pressure that's been building suddenly exercise itself.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Ron Brown. We're talking about what's happening in the stock market, what's happening in the commodity market. And, of course, everything is manipulated. And, of course, you can get away with this if you were isolated in the world. In other words, if we still had our tariff barriers, if we still were one country, well, we're no longer. They pushed us into globalism. So now we are subject to the things that are going on in the rest of the world. And, of course, the fact that the oil price is rising, and it's really rising because, there is a conscious effort to raise the price of oil on the part of the Arabs. Why? Because the value of the dollar has dropped almost 40%. So they're actually getting 40% less than they did before. So really, they're not getting $50 a barrel for the oil. They're getting a neighborhood of $30 a barrel in constant dollars as of what the value of the dollar was about 2 years ago. So they're not getting that much more. It's simply that the dollar has been devalued that far. And so that, of course, we're beginning to feel the ravages of rising prices of oil, not because the price of oil is really going up, but because the value of the dollar is going down. Now, we've been able to maintain our imports from China, because the Chinese currency, which is pegged with American currency, when the American dollar drops, the Chinese currency drops, and of course China then is able to have funnel into this country massive amounts of material, and of course the American people are still buying and buying and buying and buying. We are certainly keeping the economy of the whole world going, but we're going further and further into debt. As far as our trade deficit is concerned, as far as our federal deficit is concerned, as far as our state deficits, and here in California, as of June of next year, we'll actually owe $50 billion just this one state. And, of course, many of our municipalities are bankrupt as well. But it's all built upon debt. And the trouble with this debt, the piper is going to have to be paid. And when that happens, why I really tremble for what's going to happen to so many of the people who are head over heels in debt for the new car, in debt for the new house, in debt for the new motorboat, and in debt for the new ski boat. And what's really happening, and I think we're already beginning to see it, is why General Motors can't sell their cars. And so they're cutting their production 5%. Ford Motor Company can't sell their cars. They're cutting production 5%. General Motors has a debt of $68 billion for health insurance costs for the retirees, and they only made $1.4 billion this year. How are they going to, of course, pay off all the money that they promised, and they have made these contracts with unions to provide health care for all these people who should have been dead, when they were 65, and now they're living up to 85, 95, 100 years of age. And, of course, these people are still getting health care benefits from General Motors. And this is driving General Motors right into the ground with a profit of $101.4 billion this year and debts of $68 billion for health insurance that you are obligated to pay. How long can you keep going like that? And I think that many of our major corporations, because of the pension fund obligations, because of their health care obligations, are simply going to find it much, much cheaper simply to move out of the United States, renege on their obligations, and, of course, set the base of their operation in other countries. And when that happens, the industrial base of this country will simply be a remembrance of things past, and America, as we've known it, will no longer be the great industrial nation of the engine of the world, but become a third world nation. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Ron Brown, and we're just talking about what's happening to our economy and my concerns. And of course, Ron, what do you see happening as far as the economy here? We're told that a lot of our corporations are making a lot more money this year. Their incomes are up, but that's not because they're making the money here in the United States. It's because they moved the base of their operations overseas, and they're manufacturing things so much cheaper overseas and then selling them here into this country.
Well, and of course, a lot of them are making money through speculation and the carry trade and these highly leveraged investments they're making, betting on currencies and so forth. So it's not coming from their normal operations. In addition, of course, as you say, they're outsourcing, so it's not necessarily coming into the U.S. The common question I get from people, and you and I have been fighting this battle for, what, 20-something years? Or
I've been at it for 42 years, so I've been at it a lot longer than you have, Rod.
I'm a late comer to the battle. And back in 78, I guess, is when I really got involved. But, you know, we look at the fundamentals of what's going on, and we say it just can't go on forever. And yet somehow they pull another rabbit out of their hat, and they get another surge, and it keeps going. So after a while, people start saying, well, Ron, I've been hearing you, and I hear what you're saying, and it makes sense logically, but they always find a way to pull it out. Can't they hold this thing together forever? And that's what people kind of get into thinking. You know, it doesn't happen when I thought it would happen, so I assume they can always keep it going. And of course, that isn't the case. It always lasts longer than we think it can, but they can't keep it going forever. And I would just relate back to the 70s, because I see the same thing happening now. Back in the 70s, remember, we had the Vietnamese War, and we had Johnson with his guns and butter policies, where they kept the domestic socialism going while they fought the war, and we started going into inflation, and prices started to rise. And once people perceived, and this is the key, until people perceive it, it can keep going. But once people perceive that inflation is rising, then suddenly they say, I can't leave my money invested at 3% in CDs or T-bills when I know that there's 6, 7, 8% inflation. I've got to find another way to invest my money. So savers have to become speculators, and part of that speculative money goes into tangibles, because it's the value of the currency that's losing money. And if you're making 3%, and as you said earlier, and inflation's running 5, 6, 7%, the treadmill is going faster than you are. So people have to find another way to invest, and that's when they start going into speculative investments, go into tangibles, and gold and silver is one of the things they go into. If you recall, back in the 70s, silver went from $1.29 in early 1970, and by 1980, 8, 9 years later, silver went through $52 an ounce. Well, here we are 25 years later. People have been living in prosperity for all these years, with the stock market going up and then the real estate values going up. And so who would need gold and silver when you're making 10, 15, 20% a year on your real estate? Let's put everything into real estate. But as we said, the currency is going down. It's lost 40% of its value. As a result, foreigners have to raise their prices in terms of dollars, so that's why oil price has gone from, what, $20-something dollars a barrel to it's hit as high as $50 a barrel. Now, here's the key. At that point, no one can pretend there is no inflation, because every time you go to fill up your car and you're paying $2 or $2.20 for a gallon of gas, I don't know what you're paying out in California, and you go to the store and everything you're buying is going up in price, and your insurance is going up, so all of a sudden, the perception of inflation is starting to set in on people. And at that point, they will start to change their investments. And I think after the election is when this will start to accelerate.
Well, it's interesting, you know, how perception really controls and motivates people. We have a local Kmart store that's closing. It's going out of business. So everything is marked down. Real bargains, 10 or 20%. What people don't understand is they're raising, of course, the prices. And one of my friends was down there, and they were putting new prices on the products. He looked underneath for the old price, and it was, of course, much less than the new price they were putting on, which they were discounting. But everybody perceived that they were getting a bargain, and so that you look at that parking lot. Of course, the store is going to close the end of this month, and everybody thinks they're going to get something for nothing or get a good price. Whereas it's all a matter of perception, and that's exactly what's happening in the stock market today. It's happening as far as the economy is concerned, but they can't do away with sound economics. Things have value. They've progressively devalued our currency. So the dollar of today was worth probably 3 or 4 cents back at the turn of the century. The Federal Reserve System has created an artificial monetary system. The whole world is, I believe, teetering on the verge of a financial collapse. And there are only a few of us who are here saying, don't you know what's happening? We'll be back in just a moment with Ron Brown, and welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Ron Brown. And, of course, I don't think that we can understand what's going on in our society today at all unless we understand that there really is a grand plan. And I believe that grand plan calls for impoverishing the American people. In fact, that grand plan is laid out in something called the Earth Charter. You can go up on the web and find it, the Earth Charter, written by that great American patriot, Mikhail Gorbachev, along with Maurice Strong, a multi-billionaire, and of course Stephen Rockefeller, a multi-billionaire. But they have written the Earth Charter, and point 10 is they want to redistribute the wealth within nations and between nations. Now, they're not going to redistribute their wealth. Don't think for 1 minute that they're going to give up their billions of dollars. They want, of course, to redistribute your wealth, because that's how socialism works. And these people are all dedicated socialists. And by socialism, I mean a system where you have a ruling elite that, of course, in the name of the people, redistributes the wealth of the people, of course. And, of course, so we're seeing the redistribution of wealth within this nation, but also between nations. And this is the thing that really concerns me. Instead of trying to build up the economies of the rest of the world and have America, of course, maintain its position as world leader, their intent is to destroy the economy of this country by shifting our jobs, by shifting our manufacturing base offshore. Of course, we're destroying the lumbering industry here. We're destroying the mining industry here. We're destroying the manufacturing industry here. We're destroying the fishing industry here, and shifting this all to other countries, because these people have a different agenda, because they have a different worldview. And people say, that's crazy. Why would anybody want to do things like that? Why, it's simply because they look at the world differently than we do. And I think this is going to have tremendous implications here. As America goes from being the world leader, and I fear that while our attention is diverted at what's happening over in Iraq, as the casualties continue to rise, as we see those spectacles of flaming oil fields or another, of course, car bomb going off, and why our attention is being diverted overseas while we're losing our freedom here at home. This is exactly what happened during the Vietnam era, as they changed the immigration laws, as they centralized power in Washington, D.C., as they brought in the Great Society, as they found that a woman had suddenly a right that had been unrecognized in our Constitution for almost 200 years. She had the right to kill her child within her body, even if it was partially born. All of those rights were found during the Vietnam War, when our attention was deflected overseas. We'll be back here in just a moment with Ron Brown. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest this evening is Ron Brown, and we're talking about what's happening economically. Ron, you've actually written a fascinating treatise. I've read it, and I think it's very good, trying to explain people what's happening financially. Would you like to tell people what that is about, and of course how they can get a free copy?
I wrote it back in March, and it's really talking about how the monetary system is spinning out of control, and they have to keep the inflation going. And then it talks about silver, which I think is the greatest investment opportunity in the world right now. Of course, it's been covered up for so long that people don't see it as an opportunity. But anyway, if anyone would like a copy of it, they can just call me at my 800 number. That's 1-800-595-0561.
What's that number again?
1-800-595-0561.
Well, now, Ron, but we've been talking about the silver being a great opportunity for a year and a half, 2 years we've been talking, and yet the price of silver got up to $8, and then it went right back down to $6, and almost $5, and now it is up in the low 600s. So if it's a great buy, why isn't the price going up?
Well, I think we got to quit looking at our nose and step back and say, let's first look at the fundamentals of this thing and see if we can understand the fundamentals of what's going on, and then try to put some sense to it. Well, if you think about silver, back in 1963, when the industrial demand for silver had been rising for 50 years during the Industrial Revolution, and silver goes heavily into a lot of industrial applications, the industrial demand for silver was competing with the monetary demand for silver as money, and there literally was not enough silver to meet both needs. So the price of silver started rising to the point where the cost of silver in a dime, for example, was more than 10 cents. At that point, the monetary authorities had a little problem, and their solution, of course, was to demonetize silver, take the silver out of the coinage, and dump all of that monetary silver into the industrial markets, basically saying, industrial users, you can have it all, because we no longer need silver for money. Well, when they did that, they literally dumped somewhere around 6 to 8, some people say 10 billion ounces of silver that literally had taken 4,000 years of history to accumulate. So dumping that much silver in the market obviously had a tremendous impact. It forced the price of silver down ridiculously low, destroyed the incentive for the miners to go out and look for more. Why go out and pay $5 or $6 an ounce to mine something you can only sell for a buck or two? So the mining industry has literally gone to pot over the last 40 years. And so for 40 years, we've literally been consuming our seed corn. That 8 billion ounces was enough to take care of deficits. And we were consuming more silver than we were producing, but not to worry, because we got 8 billion ounces out there to take up the slack. Well, 40 years later, guess what? We have now consumed all that silver. But for 40 years, silver was out of sight, out of mind as an investment for the average person because it wasn't doing anything. But they don't understand it was because of that massive glut, which is now gone. Now, at the very moment, the world is starting to run out of silver. For example, there's only 110 million ounces of silver in storage on the COMEX, and that is by far the largest storage of silver anywhere in the world. So that 8 billion ounces is down, let's say, down to 1 billion ounces. At the very moment, people are starting to lose confidence in paper money. And when people do that, then they tend to want to take some of their paper money and invest it in historical money, which is silver and gold. And at that point, try to imagine, so let's say we have a $100 trillion monetary system out there around the globe. If just 0.1% of that tried to get into silver, you're talking about $100 billion trying to get into $4 or $5 billion worth of silver. So it's just a question of time before something triggers the psychology of the markets where people perceive that they need to buy some silver, which is what happened back in the 70s, and I think it's about to happen now, as I described earlier, as people perceive inflation. And how can you hide from inflation now? Then they will start to seek the refuge of gold and silver, and at that point, silver could explode, just as it did back in late 78 when it went from $5 an ounce to $52 an ounce in 12 months. Well, this time around, 25 years later, we've got 10 to 20 times more paper money, and yet we've been consuming the above-ground silver, so at best we have 1/4 as much silver today as we did back then. So it's an explosion ready to happen for the people who can see it.
I think that the trouble is that most people can't see it. That they know something's wrong, but they really don't understand the fundamentals of economics. And you were talking earlier about how, of course, during the Vietnam War, why we had guns and butter, and they just didn't bother to pay for the war. They simply stole all the, it was that time that they put the Social Security Fund into the general fund, and they stole that $200 billion a year to pay for the war. And then, of course, they were borrowing money elsewhere and inflating the money supply. So that by 1970, let's see, was the war ended in 74, but Richard Nixon came into office in 68. By 1971, why, we had an inflation rate of almost 5%. And, of course, other countries were coming to the United States with their dollars because they could exchange their dollars for gold. Americans couldn't own gold, but foreigners could own gold. And they wanted, of course, to get gold to back their currencies. They didn't want to be stuck with American dollars, which were progressively losing their value. So on August 15th of that year, Richard Nixon closed the gold window, but it was only temporarily. And then he imposed wage and price controls to try to control the rampant inflation, which was almost 5%. Well, of course, the wage and price controls don't work, and things were really getting out of kilter after that. So then, of course, over the next decade, why there was gradually and progressive inflation, Richard Nixon left office, Gerald Ford came in, then, of course, Jimmy Carter came in. And by the time Jimmy Carter got to the end of his time in office and ran up a $200 billion deficit, we were, of course, approaching inflation rates of somewhere 15-16%, and they had to raise the interest rates up to 19-20% to try to stop the inflation. And I think it was amazing that they did, and they were able to stop the inflation in its tracks. But it was at that time, of course, that the price of silver went right through the roof, as did the price of gold and the price of platinum. But they were able, of course, by raising the interest high enough to cool down the economy, to cool down the prices of those precious metals. But then they've been building now for 25 years since then, and it looks like we're headed right back into the same situation. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. You know, at the end of that blow-off in 1980, the national debt had not even reached the first $1 trillion.
Right, and today, of course, the national debt that we will admit to is $7.38 trillion. But what people really don't understand, there's about $4.5 trillion of that is actual money that is owed to foreigners, and the rest, of course, is the debt for the Social Security, it's the IOUs. But they don't talk about the real debt, which is not $7.38 trillion. It's $72 trillion, because that is what we promised to pay, and we have no means of raising the money to do that. They're into the same problem in Germany. They're in the same problem in Japan. Countries throughout the world have made the promises to the people that we're going to take care of you when you get to be older, and there's just no way they're going to do it. This is the thing that really is so disturbing. So they've got to have some sort of a great diversion so that people don't realize that, you know, what is really happening, you know, is they're being deprived of what they've been promised. They don't want the people in the street rioting. So I think this is why they are manipulating us into an even larger war. It's only a matter of time before we go to war with Iran, before we go to war with Syria, perhaps even with Saudi Arabia. But the American people are going to think this was just forced on us. Oh, it was those terrible Iranians. They were plotting to blow us all up with nuclear weapons. And, well, maybe they will if they feel threatened. Other countries are not going to attack the United States. We're too powerful. But, of course, if their very existence is threatened, why, you never know what a desperate person will do. And this is my fear, is that we are laying the foundation for a tremendous worldwide conflict, which will draw the attention away, the people's attention away from the fact that the politicians have been lying to them for the better part of this last century.
Well, you know, the monetary authorities really, as we've said over and over, are trapped. They have to keep the system growing. I was reading Jim Poplava tonight before we came on. In fact, he did a real good article for anyone that would want to read it. It's go to financialsense.com, S-E-N-S-E, and read the article he did on the carry trade economy. But anyway, he was in that article, he was saying our debt structure in this nation is increasing by $2 trillion a year.
Now, is that the federal, or is that the
overall?
Well, that
would be all debt, I'm sure. Right. See, they've created so much leverage and so much speculation in the private sector that the private sector debt really is growing faster than the government debt. But that's the one that is more vulnerable, because that's the one, see, the government at least has a printing press to keep their system going. But when the bubble pops on the private sector, they're somewhat limited.
Well, I think that Jim Poplava is one of the cleverest people we have. In fact, we did an interview with him about 2 weeks ago. It was really a great interview, and I think what he said was really so sound economically.
Right. I follow him, and I, in fact, every Saturday morning I go to his website, and they have a two-hour radio program on the Internet that people can listen to, so I would highly recommend it.
Of course. So what is their website? Is that financialsense.com?
Right, and if you just go to their broadcast, then they have, you can go back into the archives and go back, you know, 2 or 3 months and pick out the title that makes sense to you and just listen to them, and it'll really change the way you think, because they throw out so many facts, just like you do, Dr. Stan. You study this so much that you throw out facts that people are just saying, wow.
Well, because we try to back whatever we say. Of course, I listen to Jim Poplava. The program you're talking about is actually produced by my good friend John Leffler.
That's right.
And they do that one together. And a tremendous amount of information out there, but you're not going to get this through the controlled media. So if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question for Ron, who I think is a sound basis in what we're talking about, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Our guest this evening is Ron Brown, and of course he's in the gold and silver coin business. He supports Radio Liberty, but I found his information has been very, very valid, and of course I think that the treatise that he wrote up there in March of this year, trying to explain how this all fits together, was one of the better pieces that I've actually read. I was very impressed by it. And again, you want to give that telephone number in case people would like to get a copy of it?
Sure, just call me at 1-800-595-0561. That's 1-800-595-0561.
Okay, fine. And of course, I think one of the most interesting things, we've talked about this before, but for our listeners who do not know what Warren Buffett is doing, Warren Buffett is certainly one of the smartest people around. Warren Buffett started out in 1956 by investing $100 in a privately held family corporation for investment, and today his holdings are worth about $40 billion. That's $40 billion. He's an excellent investor. I believe he knows what's going on. I think he's in contact with the people who pull the strings and control the economy. And Warren Buffett, as of the first half of this year, as of the end of June of this year, had invested Berkshire Hathaway's funds. Now his shares of Berkshire Hathaway are worth $60,000 or $70,000 a share. I can remember when they were $10 a share. I have 20/20 hindsight, but he is investing money from Berkshire Hathaway in foreign currency futures. Now, what are foreign currency futures? Why, they're really future, like a commodity market, a derivative market, highly leveraged betting that the American dollar is going to fall. If he is wrong, he's going to lose an awful lot of money. But, of course, Warren Buffett ordinarily doesn't lose a lot of money. Forbes came out for the richest 500 people in the world, 400 or 500 people, and Warren Buffett was, by their judgment, number two in the world. And when Warren Buffett is investing his currencies overseas, not only that, but he's in derivatives. He's got $19 billion invested betting against the dollar and highly leveraged investments. Why, I think that every one of us should be concerned. Now, this article appeared one time in the Wall Street Journal on page C3, and nobody ever gets back to C3, especially down at the bottom of the page where you never would see this unless you knew it was there. If any of you would like a copy of that article about what Warren Buffett is doing, we'd be glad to send it to you. Or, of course, it's covered in my August newsletter, and we'd be glad to send any of you a free copy of the August newsletter. If you call us at 1-800-544-8927, that's 1-800-544-8927. And if you'd like to see the article or simply get my newsletter, which I think gives you a good overview, at least my interpretation of what's going on and where we are headed, taking not only what Warren Buffett says, but what Alan Greenspan actually wrote back in 1996 and what Dr. Paul Craig Roberts says, and you put it all together and you realize that we are on the edge of a financial precipice, and the average person doesn't realize, of course, what's beyond that precipice. We could lose the economy that we have here in America. I believe there's an organized, intentional effort to convert America into a third world country. And the average person said, that could never happen here. And I would ask why it can't happen. We have nothing behind the value of our money other than the confidence of our politicians. And, of course, how many of you really would want to trust the politicians with your wife or with the value of future generations? And so I think that we're going to have to accept the fact we're in real trouble, and we're not going to turn things around. All we can do is suggest, at least for the people who listen to us, to begin to prepare for the very difficult times that lie ahead. Ron, what should people be doing in your estimation?
Well, they have to protect them. You know, Buffett is a tremendous study in what's going on in this country. I happen to know someone back in New Mexico that was kin to him, and when he was farming Berkshire Hathaway, and I don't remember what year that was, but it was, what, 20, 30 years ago?
Right.
He scrambled, this person scrambled, to buy 150 shares of this, and it was in the hundreds of dollars a share or less, you know. And here he is, what, 30, 40 years later, it's worth $70,000 a share.
$70,000.
Somewhere. I haven't looked at the price lately.
It was 60 to 70, somewhere in there.
Right. And it's been as high as 80,000. But what's interesting is, see, Buffett was a brilliant investor, but the way he invested was by finding value in stocks, not developing in momentum-type trades or speculation, but just very conservative companies with value. And yet here he is saying there is none anymore, and the only way to survive is to speculate. So that should be a lesson to everyone that's listening. Here's a brilliant investor, and he's saying the only way is to bet against the dollar and so forth. That's why I think gold and silver really is the primary way that people need to try to protect themselves from what's about to happen to the currency.
Well, I think that if Warren Buffett doesn't have any confidence in the dollar, should we? And, of course, what are you going to do to protect your value? Well, you may not get rich, but you want to protect what you have. And this is why we put the programs on, suggesting that people begin taking action to protect themselves for the uncertain future. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Ron Brown. And so we just got a few minutes to wrap up the program this evening. We do have a caller, though. We've got Bernice calling from Michigan. Hi, Bernice. How are you doing?
Good. Fine. How are you?
Just fine. Yes. Want to speak up there?
Yes. Okay. This is just a little bit off the subject, but I listened last night, too. And I loved what you said, and I think you told me who quoted it, but I missed it. When the government fears the people, there's freedom. But when the people fear the government and reprisals, there's tyranny.
That's right. That's a wonderful quotation.
And who was it?
I don't know who said it.
I don't remember.
No, I just I said it, and I'm sure I got it from somebody else, but I don't.
Well, either Jefferson it. Or
Jefferson.
I'm not sure he was one. But it was one of those back in.
I'll tell you what, Bernice, if I can ever find it, I'll let you know. But I really can't. I know the origin of most of the quotations, but I don't know the origin of that one.
I thought it was beautiful, and you know, like I was telling your young lady on the phone. When you're poor, I don't have a lot of money. I'm a widow, and I draw widow's benefits. I'm an old lady. But I said, I don't know. I don't have enough money to go out and buy gold. She said, well, buy a few. Smart, buy some dimes and nickels. Okay, I can do that.
Buy them, of course, buy silver dimes and nickels. Don't buy the traditional ones. That's all you can do, Bernice. Of course, you're going to have to, of course, rely upon the Lord and hope that there'll be a good God-fearing people there to lend you a hand. We're going to help one another in the difficult times that lie ahead. And I hope you have other friends there, or people that you know you can trust and talk to. And we're going to have to, of course, do everything we can to help one another. But if we can't help ourselves, we can't help others.
Yes, well, I can sure try.
Anyway, Bernice, are you in Detroit or Flint?
I'm in the Detroit area.
Okay, fine.
Remember,
well,
this is where all so many of the Arabs are.
I know. Well, of course, we're going to have, I fear, very, very real problems down the line. I think it was planned that way.
Yeah,
Thank you so much for calling, and please tell others about our program, will you?
I sure will. My son listened to you last night. So, yeah, there is one more I've got.
Good night, and God bless.
Okay, God bless.
And of course, Ron, I want to thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure to have you. Look forward to having you back here in the near future again.
It's always great to be with you, Dr. Stan.
Well, good night, and thanks so very much. Well, this guest this evening has been Ron Brown. We're just talking about the economy. No planned program at all. And so we just want to bring out the facts, what I think is important. Watch and see what Warren Buffett's doing, because he's a lot smarter than just about most anybody I know. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, we're talking about what's happening economically. If any of you would like a copy of my August newsletter, which I think gives you a pretty good appraisal of what's going on, tells you what Warren Buffett really thinks, tell you what Alan Greenspan really thinks, tell you what Paul Craig Robert really thinks. Of course, he's actually written it out so you can actually read it in his article, which I certainly commend to you. But I've taken some, I think, great quotations and woven them together in what I think is an outstanding newsletter. Of course, I'm a little prejudiced, but if you'd like a free copy of our August newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. The September newsletter is just finished, and of course we've gone into the background of even more so of what's happening economically, gone into the background, of course, of how we got into the situation we are, who really controls America, who controls the media, and we go back, of course, to what happened during the time, the revolutionary times. What was Thomas Jefferson saying about the banking system in America? Who controlled the banking system then, and who controls the banking system now? And what is their goal, and what is their objective? And it's entirely different than most people think. Their goal is not primarily to make money. You have to understand that any more than people will try to tell you, and you'll hear this so often, well, the reason we go into wars is for people to make money. And I make the point, no, that is not the reason we go into wars. Any more than wet streets do not cause rain, so war profits do not create the wars. They are a benefit to the people who make the profit of the wars, but of course they are not the cause of the wars. And you have to understand that there is another agenda behind everything going on. We cover that, I think, quite well in my video, Iraq, the Untold Story, and there's a syllabus that goes with that. And if you really want to understand the wars of the last century, you need to get that video, you need to get the syllabus, because it has all the documents in there that will prove to you that the Spanish-American War was started fraudulently, America's entry into the First World War was fraudulent, Adolf Hitler was financed and backed by the people in this organization. We created the best enemy money could buy. The Japanese wanted to surrender for 6 months, and we wouldn't let them surrender. And the invasion of Iwo Jima and Okinawa and the dropping of the bombs was totally unnecessary. But, you see, all you know is what you're told today by the pundits who are controlled by the people who control the media. And if you read my September newsletter, which will be available, you'll have to request a copy in 10 days or so when those are available. But the people who control the media don't want you to know history. And my job is to let you know history and give you the newspaper articles that were written 50, 60 years ago so that you can begin to understand the betrayal that has taken place then, the betrayal that's taken place today. So if you'd like to get the information we're talking about, the video and the syllabus, Iraq, the Untold Story, why, you may want to call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We hope if you're living in the Monterey Bay area, you'll consider attending a class of the Institute of the Constitution that's being held in Salinas at actually every Saturday morning. Why don't you call 877-448-5798? But even call this time of night. I bet Alex would still be up. 877-448-5798. What we need is for people to learn about the Constitution. And, of course, then they can discuss intelligently what's going on. You have to understand the foundations of our freedom if you hope to preserve the freedom. And then, of course, we hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to coming to our all-day conference on the 6th of November. It's going to be held at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course on the North Shore of Monterey Bay, one of the most beautiful areas in the world, because I've lived here for many years. I've lived elsewhere in the world. I've traveled throughout the world, and I still will come back here every time. With all the problems we have in California, it's a wonderful place to live. So if you're interested in coming to our Saturday conference, lunch will be served, outside speakers coming in, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then please pray for America, pray for revival, pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection until Monday. May the Lord be with you.